You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2012 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. Good evening and welcome to Aloud at Central Library. Great to see such a good audience here. I'm very pleased to welcome you. I'm Louise Steinman, the program director for the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Lisa Randall beautifully details the excitement of pursuing science, the possibility of providing a more comprehensive picture of the nature of reality. The challenge scientists face, she writes, is to persevere with promising ideas while all the time questioning them to ascertain their veracity and their implications. Scientists experiment and calculate to eliminate as many uncertainties as possible, though, as Lisa Randall points out, research is by its nature at the edge of what we know. And working at the edge of what we know is a place where Lisa Randall is thrilled to be, for as she reminds us, we are currently living in an extraordinarily exciting era for physics and cosmology with some of the edgiest investigations ever proposed, which we'll hear about tonight. Lisa Randall is professor of theoretical physics at Harvard University and one of the most influential living scientists. She has published two papers in partnership with Raman Sundram that have transformed the ways physicists think about the underlying structure of space by showing that the hidden dimensions required by string theory could be not just large, but infinite, providing space was warped in the right way. I love saying that. It's great. Tonight, Randall, who is, the Frank B. Baird Jr. Professor of Science at Harvard, will discuss how physics and scientific thinking illuminate the universe and the modern world, which is the subject of her new book, Knocking on Heaven's Door. Randall is the best-selling author of Warped Passages, Unraveling the Mysteries of the Universe's Hidden Dimensions. She studies theoretical particle physics and cosmology, and her research connects the theoretical insights to puzzles and our current understanding of the properties and interactions of matter. Her current research focuses in large part on the Large Hadron Collider and dark matter searches and models, but her interests also encompass art-science connections, such as the libretto she wrote for Hypermusic, a projective opera in seven planes that premiered at the Pompidou in 2009, and Measure for Measure, an art exhibit she co-curated here in Los Angeles in 2010. And I think her love of conversation with people in diverse disciplines is also evident tonight in her conversation with her friend Linda Opes, best known as an award-winning film and television producer. Linda has made films at almost every major motion picture studio, including such titles as Contact, Sleepless in Seattle, The Siege, One Fine Day, and The Fisher King. But most importantly for tonight, you should know that Linda is an abiding science geek and studied philosophy of science at Columbia. So please join me in welcoming our guests, Lisa Randall and Linda Opes, to the Los Angeles Public Library. Thank you.
Very excited you all can be with us so that you can eavesdrop on my favorite thing, which is talking to Lisa. We enjoy conversations together and I'd like to invite you in on really the most interesting topics in the world. And Lisa sits at the most exciting edge of these issues, sort of modeling questions for the experimenters to figure out right now, questions that we've been wondering about for the past 5,000 years since people could ask these questions. What sorts of things are there? What's matter made of? What exists in the world at the fundamental levels? And how do we really think about these questions that philosophers have wondered about since time began. And the wonderful thing about living in the world right now is that we're not just positing these questions and coming up with answers of our own. We have instruments and technology that can actually address these questions, and scientists like Lisa who can help the experimenters figure out how to address these questions. The great thing about Lisa's book, there are many great things about this book, apart from the fact that it's really readable and juicy. Mine is dog-eared. as I
it proved, really is.
It really is. Exclamation point in the margins. Is that it? It really helps all of us understand how these questions are raised in science. And one of the great things I want to ask Lisa to sort of start the way the book starts and talk to us about how science posits questions. And the, you raised these questions in the book, first of all, through Galileo's eyes. You look at Galileo as sort of the first scientist who used instruments as a way to, and a particular instrument, the telescope, as a way of looking at the universe. And that was a paradigm changer for you.
So, you know,
you were in Padua, I think, when you started to think about
right.
that. Tell us about
that. It was funny because I already knew I was writing this book, and it's sort of like, you know, when you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail. But I was just traveling for a physics conference. It was actually kind of fun because it was a physics conference, and I was also getting a key to the city of Padua, which is really fantastic. But at the time, it was also the celebration of Galileo. It was the anniversary of his famous work. And so they had an exhibit about Galileo. And it was really interesting because I hadn't quite appreciated his role in, it's not just instrumentation, but also indirect vision. So before that, there were instruments. People made very precise measurements. Kepler made very precise measurements.
Of orbits.
But what was different about what Galileo realized, I mean, the telescope existed. I mean, there's a reason it was called a spyglass. It was like a, it was a fun thing that you could spy on people with. And he realized that it had these dramatic implications for actually looking at the universe. And so what was really radical about it was that it's indirect. You don't actually see it with your eye directly. You see it indirectly. And the reason that's so important, of course, is that the kind of experiments going on today are in many respects indirect, and people will question their veracity and what we're really seeing and what is really true. But of course, our eyes are actually very unreliable measuring instruments, whereas these tools that he had, and not only a telescope, he also was one of the first to really appreciate what a microscope could do, which I hadn't realized. So he was looking both, he really was addressing this broad range of questions about the large and the small, realizing he could see things that you otherwise wouldn't see and observe and know how to interpret it, and even thinking about the role of scale. So there was just these very deep fundamental ways of thinking that he really changed under his tutelage and others at the time.
Because up until Galileo, really science was the province of philosophers. It was sort of how you thought about things, how you reasoned.
Well,
but
it was,
instruments
it was a
didn't mediate it that much, did they?
It was a mixture. I mean, when they were measuring the planets, they were measuring the planets and they were developing the orbits of the planets. And so it wasn't only that. I mean, they
there
did realize that they realized that they could make numbers that said where things were. But it really was, but it did turn it much more into a science at that time. Understanding, the other important thing about Galileo was that he didn't just realize you can use experiments to verify theories. You could rule out theories by making measurements. So he really, this whole scientific method was evolving. And he wasn't the only one, but just the idea that you... So he not only did what we call observation through a telescope and through a microscope, but he designed experiments. Mm-hmm. I mean, so he really designed, you know, inclined planes are something you learn about in physics. And I never understood quite why we always learn. But he actually had experiments with inclined planes. And they were incredibly clever, too, because he had bells that would ring. He had really good ears, so he could actually test how quickly things were falling as a function of their mass. So, and again, he was both verifying certain types of theories and ruling out other ones. And so it was a very sophisticated way of understanding nature.
This notion of designing experiments, that's modeling, isn't it, in some sense? Was that an early form of modeling experiments?
Well, you know, modeling can mean many different things. And I kind of joke about that. But
America's new best, but the next top model.
But in this case, it's true. So someone could have a theory. So you could say, you know, things fall at the same rate if they have different masses, or you could say they fall at different rates if they have different masses. So that's in some sense a model. I mean, that's my model of how the physical laws should work. And then by doing an experiment, I can measure which of these models is right. So in that case, it's not even modeling reality. It is reality. I mean, he is really testing how gravity works. Mm-hmm. So I'd say sort of the theorist is more modeling it, or right. The idea. And then he's just verifying whether or not it's true.
And then you point out that, of course, he died on the day that Newton was born.
Or at least the year. It's very hard to verify these things very accurately. But it's truly true that was the heyday of the scientific revolution. I mean, it was just, things were changing at that time.
And after Newton, of course, the great breakthrough for physics was Einstein. And then we get relativity, which had enormous implications, obviously, for physics. I'm a kind of relativity freak. It's so incredibly exciting. And then we developed this new whole class of telescopes. And this new class of telescopes became giant telescopes, much bigger than the telescope that Galileo used, needless to say. We got giant telescopes that were earthbound. And we were able to start testing some of Einstein's ideas long after there was no Einstein. And then we, of course, got spacebound telescopes. How much of these earthbound and then spacebound telescopes were able to confirm or deny or confirm what Einstein was up to?
So I'm just going to go back to Galileo for 1 second and say one of the really nice things last year, which was well after the book came out, but I was in, I was actually in Florence, and they have the Galileo Museum there. And they actually have his original telescope, which is very cool. The one that, you know, was only a magnification factor of about 20. I mean, it was not a huge magnet, but it was enough to do the amazing things he did to establish what's going on with Saturn and with Jupiter's planets.
And he's the first to see Saturn's rings.
And it was about 20 times. The other thing that was very amusing about this museum is it, which probably most people don't know, is it also has his finger and teeth.
It does?
It actually has relics, which is just hilarious
like
in the context of, yeah, the context of Galileo fighting the church, and there it is with all this. Anyway, it's very funny.
That's my kind of saint.
Yeah, exactly. It really was funny. You just kind of wonder, like, what would he have thought if he knew this was there? But in terms of telescopes today, you know, to some extent, we just take relativity for granted. You know, it's just part of the theory. I mean, it was, Einstein's theory was tested early on. Mm-hmm. And in fact, when I wrote War Passages, I talked to Jerry Holton about the whole story. Because, you know, the question is, what was really going on? And it was very interesting because it was after the World War, and they just wanted to sort of unite physicists together. So it really was important that a British physicist could go out and test a German physicist's theory. So that was part of the motivation behind this major expedition, which was able
nationalistic?
Or the opposite. It was sort of to say, like, we can all work together. Science is universal, and so we can test. So at that time, Einstein's theory was tested, you know, it was tested in many ways. You know,
the gravitational fact that lens was the first test.
Many tests, but no, the eclipse was one, the perihelion of Mercury, and so today's telescopes are using relativity in some sense. I mean, of course, if anything went against what was predicted, that would be major. But right now, we assume, so for example, in addition to telescope, that you're talking about, there's also cosmic microwave background measurements.
Right.
Which are, you know, through satellites out in the sky, and you assume relativity, but then you assume various parameters of the universe, how much energy there is, how much dark matter there is, do we have closure density, is it critical density? So just all these different components that go into it.
Let's talk about the cosmic background radiation, right? Because do you guys know about that? Do we know that there is a little ringing going on from the Big Bang? Ding! Right? Let's talk about that, Lisa.
Well, you know, this. So the ironic thing about the Big Bang Theory, which I always find ironic, is that, well, first of all, the name was a joke. I'm making fun of it. But also we know a lot about the Big Bang, except for what banged in the beginning. So we know the later stages. And one of the tests that this theory was right is that there is this radiation around that was there and it's cooled down. What makes it so exciting for cosmology today is that it really was part of what turned cosmology into a precision science. And the reason it wasn't a precision science before, well, there are several reasons, the tools weren't available. But also, by today, there's a lot of what we call nonlinear processing that's gone. It's very hard to make predictions because everything is in stuff like stars and Earth, and there's a lot of things that are hard to predict without knowing every detail of what happened. But way back at the time that the cosmic microwave background is measured, what happened was electrons and protons combined so that the photons now come directly to us. There's no longer charged stuff there in the universe. So you can have a window directly back in the sky and make very clean, precise measurements that tell you the parameters of the universe. And that is why cosmology has radically changed recently, in part because of that, and in part then you can do it in conjunction with other things that are numerical techniques that allow us to understand how everything has evolved.
So really, how many years has it been that we've that cosmology has gotten so solid? First, we were able to measure this cosmic background radiation. Right. Then we've been able to measure really the space and time since the Big Bang. We've been able to measure the distance between quasars, the earliest.
So some of those measurements were going on earlier on, and they've just become more precise and really been able to pin down even the measurement of the Hubble parameter, how quickly things are expanding. You know, I remember when I was younger, like waking up and reading on a headline that said the Hubble, you know, that the universe is like a factor of two different in age. I don't remember if it was older or younger than we had said before. And I was really young at the time when I thought, how can they get the age of the universe off by a factor of two? It seems kind of radical. But of course, for many things, it didn't matter that much, but it's an important parameter that enters. So they were able to pin that down. But really, you know, it's like the 1990s when things started really coming together with this. And in fact, when people first said you could do these precision measurements of the cosmos, but people thought it'd be like ages before they did it, and they did it within a few years.
So, which is really, when we think about it, you know, I first started learning a little of this stuff from Carl Sagan. And when Carl was born, Fred Hoyle, who believed in the steady state theory, right, that the universe has been in the same state that it's been forever, was as reasonable to hold a theory as the Big Bang theory.
And in fact, Einstein, when he wrote down his theory, I mean, his famous mistake was that his theory actually predicted that the universe would expand or contract, and he knew that. And he tried to mess around with the parameters of the universe so that it wouldn't do that, because at the time there was no evidence that the universe was expanding or contracting. So, I mean, you know, the last century, our view of the universe changed radically.
Which is really thrilling, once again, because of instruments, right?
Absolutely.
Back to...
But also theory. I mean, it was also a combination of
real Einstein advances predicting the theory and then instruments confirming it.
And of course, the other really big advance that happened around the time of relativity was quantum mechanics, which of course changed our view of
I was going to get
small.
To that.
Yeah.
But I want to ask you first, before we get to quantum mechanics, with the same instruments, were we able to detect the fact that there might be missing mass in our universe before we get to quantum mechanics, where we're going to spend the rest of our time?
The first time that it was noticed that there was, I wouldn't say missing mass, but mass that we couldn't account for, was actually really early on. And then those measurements were made more precise. So what was measured later on was just rotation curves around galaxies, because how quickly stuff would rotate would depend on how much mass is inside there. And it was just clear that that the velocities couldn't, as you went further and further out, could not be accounted for by visible matter, which just trailed off. So there had to be other stuff that was there. And if you assumed that there was mass, it worked out pretty well. It wasn't a measurement of the total dark matter in the universe. It was mass dark matter in galaxies and before the galaxy clusters. So there was, but then here's where lensing comes in too. I mean, there was other evidence that this dark matter exists, because it's called, first of all, it's called dark matter, and that's a misnomer, because it's actually transparent matter. Because if you think about it, you can see dark things. So you might have asked yourself, why don't we see dark matter? I see my jacket. But it's actually transparent. It doesn't interact with light. That's the idea. But even if something itself doesn't interact with light, if there's a star or a bright object behind it, then it can bend the light. And so what you see are like multiple images. So you see things that bend in different directions, and that's gravitational lensing. So there's very direct evidence that there's this dark matter, because there's a place where light is bending where you just don't see anything. But there's also rotation curves of galaxies. There's also evidence from this cosmic microwave background radiation. So there's many different evidence, pieces of evidence that point to matter that exists. You know, it's funny, though. People are always very suspicious. They're like, how could there be this dark matter? But to me, it seems the opposite. Like, why should everything in the universe
be illuminated?
Be like the stuff that's like we're made of. Why should it have the same interactions that we do? And to me, if anything, and in fact, some of my research is about this, is why should the amount of dark matter or the energy carried by dark matter be so similar to the amount of energy carried by ordinary matter? It's only 6 times the amount. Could have been a trillion times the amount. So why are they so similar? So that, to me, seems like a bigger mystery.
It's a delicious mystery, I think.
Yeah, it's a good one.
It's a really good one. So these are some of the really big questions that we're addressing, because the theory has taken us here. The instrumentation has taken us here. And this is stuff from the sort of grand structure of the universe. And instrumentation and the grand structure of the universe has now also taken us to the micro-universe. And now the biggest questions... And the biggest questions we're all dealing with right now are in the micro-universe, are on the quantum level, dealing with what's happening on the smallest scales. And a lot of your work is taking place here now. And, of course, we all know that at CERN, at the Large Hadron Collider, really important experiments are going on right now that your work is helping to model. And I want to spend a lot of our time tonight, the rest of our time, talking about what's going on there, how your work has helped guide some of the questions going on at the LHC, and then we'll get to some of the biggest questions going on in the efforts of the scientists and the experimenters at the LHC. So let's talk first about just the basic mechanics of what's going on there. So tell us first about the mechanics of the LHC. What's happening? We're crashing protons?
Right.
Is that what we're doing? We're smashing watch particles
out while
so
we're doing
we see
it
what the remains are? Tell us how it works.
So first of all, I think I just want to make the point that, in a way, you know, and having written these books, you know, talk to the public, it's much harder to sort of visualize and understand these small scales. So in some sense, people are much more comfortable with the large scales. And part of the reason for that is precisely the reason small scales are so exciting, which is that we can hope to find real changes in the laws of nature that apply at these small scales. I mean, no one would have envisioned quantum mechanics without studying the atom and studying radiation and really seeing the experimental evidence, or to understand the nuclear force is a strong and weak nuclear force. So by looking at small scales, you really find totally different rules, whereas at large scales, we sort of know the rules, and it's a question of how it all fits together and what's actually out there. But that very fact that the rules change is so exciting, but it's also why it's often so hard to convey exactly what's going on. So if I don't do a perfect job, it's because it isn't classical. It really involves stuff that we don't encounter in our daily lives. In terms of the experiment itself, we should be clear that there's the machine, which is the Large Hadron Collider, and that's large because it's 27 kilometers in circumference, an underground tunnel. It's hadron because protons are a kind of particle called hadron. It could have been called the Large Proton Collider. I don't know why they didn't call it that, honestly. but it is a proton collider. And it's a collider because it literally collides them. And what happens is the protons go around this very big ring, 11,000 times a second. And every time they go around, they get a little kick, and they get slightly more energy. So they go in at one energy, they get to the highest energy we've ever had in a collider before. And in fact, it hasn't yet reached its full energy. The machine is going to shut down for an upgrade at the beginning of next year, and then it will turn back on at its full energy, we hope. So, but this, anyway, these protons go around. And there's two things that make this really magnificent in terms of the machine. One is the energy is the highest. The other is the rate of collisions is very high. They have lots of collisions happening. So, and that lots of collisions happening means there's lots of data. You know, it's a billion collisions per second. You know, it's huge. So, so you have to be really careful, and so you have to be sure that you're keeping track of what's interesting. But so there are these collisions, and then when these collisions happen, there are experiments that measure what's going on. So we hope via E equals mc squared that you have a lot of energy. It turns into new particles with right. bigger mass m than we've seen before. So, and how is that measured, though? You don't directly measure it because often these particles decay. So what they have are these concentric detectors. The two general purpose experiments that I focus on in the book are CMS and ATLAS, two different experiments. And what they do is they just try to measure everything they can about what comes out, which is to say energy and momentum and charge and whether it's charge and the strong force. And so, and then you put together what was there. They try to figure out which are the interesting events, and then from those interesting events, go back and reconstruct what was there. And if it's something that can't be accounted for mm-hmm. in what we call the standard model of particle physics, it's something new. So what they're doing is measuring the properties of things we know about very well and also looking for new stuff.
And I mean, the context in which I understand this is from philosophy, right? What we're basically looking for, what we would say in philosophy, in classical philosophy, is what sort of things are there, right?
That's
we call
a technical
that ontology,
term.
Right?
That's a technical term?
That's a technical term. Like, what's there? An ontology, we'd say, what's the world made of, right? What are the fundamental constituent particles of the universe? What's underneath, right? What are protons made of? And then what's underneath that? So at the very constituent fundamental components of nature, in the vacuum, right? What's in that vacuum? What's at the very, very basis of the vacuum?
Yeah, so let's be clear. So technically, so our technical term is vacuum. Mm-hmm. And vacuum to us means something that has no particles in it. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, according to quantum mechanics, something with no particles can still have lots of virtual particles that pop in and out of existence. It can have energy. It can have charge. So the vacuum, although we think of it as empty, could be very rich. Mm-hmm. The same way if you have your refrigerator magnet and the refrigerator door, in between you think there's nothing yet. There's something there, which is the magnetic field. Mm-hmm. So the vacuum isn't really empty. But then from the vacuum, you can produce all the particles of our universe. And so some of them really are constituents of matter we're familiar with. There are particles that have nothing to do with the stuff that we know about as far as we know, which was dark matter particles. And there's also particles that could account for properties of what we know, such as the famous Higgs boson, the now famous Higgs boson that's been discovered, and I'm sure we'll talk more about. So we're not just looking for constituents. We're looking for all the ingredients that are there. Some of it are constituents of a matter. Some of it is just stuff that's there that maybe interacts with the stuff we know about. And a lot of it is what we call unstable. It doesn't even last forever. It decays. Yet it's still a fundamental particle in our universe.
And so the Higgs boson particle that we've heard so much about, it's something that emerges from the vacuum. It's something that allows matter to be?
So this is, you know, it's a really interesting confusion. In fact, I actually wrote a short ebook this summer called Higgs Discovery, The Power of Empty Space, because it was really frustrating. First of all, I was very excited about the discovery, but also because it's a very subtle concept and it's very easy to get confused. Because it's not actually the particle, the Higgs boson, that gives other particles their masses. So first of all, So I'll explode a few myths about the Higgs boson, but in the process explain it. One is that it's the Higgs mechanism even is not responsible for most of the mass in the universe. I mean, we know there's dark matter, of course, but even the matter we know about mostly gets its mass because of the strong force, because E equals mc squared. So there's a strong nuclear force. Protons and neutrons have a mass that have nothing to do with the Higgs mechanism. But elementary particles, like the electron and the quarks inside the proton, they would not have a mass if it weren't for this thing called the Higgs mechanism. And you might say, how is it? How could that be? Isn't mass just a property of particles? But if those particles had masses from the get-go, you would make nonsensical predictions, like probabilities of interactions greater than one. So you do need a mechanism, and that mechanism is called the Higgs mechanism, named after the physicist Peter Higgs. Now, the Higgs boson is a particle that tells us that mechanism is right, and it tells us what it is that implemented the mechanism. I mean, you can ask, what is the mechanism? And that's subtle, and I try to explain it several different ways. Mm-hmm. But one way is just to think of it, like I said, there's energy throughout the universe, there's charge, there's sort of the Higgs field throughout the universe, just like right. there could be a magnetic field. And it's a little bit like there's Higgs charges throughout the universe, and it's not a big electric charge, but and particles sort of bounce off that and thereby acquire masses. So this charge spread, not the actual particles, the charge spread throughout the universe. However, if you add energy, you can excite a particle. A particle can emerge. And that's what happens at the collider. And you make these particles. And these particles have particular properties that tell you how the mechanism was implemented. What is it that provided that charge throughout the universe? What is it that provided this Higgs mechanism? And so what was so exciting about finding the particle is, first of all, we know this Higgs mechanism is right now. And we also have a clue to how it happens and how to go beyond what we know.
Now, Lisa, when you come up with problems or design experiments for the scientists at LHC, what do you think of or how do you conceive an experiment or a problem for the LHC? What do you look for in a problem or an issue?
So first of all, there's one big confusion that people have about experiments at the LHC. Because they'll ask me, are they looking for your theory? And the fact is they're looking for my theory, but they're looking for all the theories.
A theory.
They're looking for, because the experiments are sort of, there's only so much they can do. They measure all the properties of mm-hmm. the stuff. I mean, what's important about us is to tell them which could be the interesting ones. So to make sure that they record that data, because mm-hmm. they can't possibly record all the data that's there. So they have to know which one, and then how to analyze it. What is it that they're looking for? So we're not telling them like how to go about the nuts and bolts of what they're doing.
Right.
We're telling them how to analyze their data.
Data.
And what we're thinking about when we're doing that are various questions we have. How particles acquire their masses? Why do they have the masses that they do? What sets the scale? And that ends up leading to some very big ideas. And so usually when you have a big idea, it has other experimental consequences too. And it's up to us to try to figure out what those are, like what will be the other predictions of your theory and how they can go about looking for it. And a lot of the time you won't be able to say it's a particle with this precise mass, but you can say it's a particle that should have this property and should decay in this way, and it should decay, that you might be able to predict the ratio in terms of how much it decays into one, like an electron versus photons. So you can give precise predictions of that nature, which they can go back and test whether or not they're true.
What do you look for in a theory?
Yeah, it's a good question. So first of all, I'm usually looking to address some question that exists. There's some problem. I didn't make up the problem. There's a problem. Something didn't make sense. Or there just seems to be too much going on. There should be connections that we haven't yet identified. So you're looking for some explanatory power, of course. But by that, it almost implies that you want a relatively simple theory. The more complicated it is, the less you're explaining. Because if you put enough stuff in, you can do anything. And of course, it's ugly. I mean, you add too many ingredients to your soup, it's not going to taste very good. So you just want it to be something that you really feel is really giving an explanation in the sense that there's a few ingredients and you can test it. And it's not always that simple to do. I mean, sometimes you have a great idea, but then you realize there are so many constraints that are out there. I mean, it has to match everything that's been measured before. And, of course, you want something that you can ultimately test in the future, too. And, of course, the best theories, or maybe the most fun ones, are ones that do involve big ideas.
Right.
You know, it's really wonderful when you find some idea that was just there at a theoretical level. You realize it really has dramatic implications for what can be happening.
Give me a version of that.
Well, it's somewhat technical, but one of the questions that exists now at the Large Hadron Collider, in addition to properties of the Higgs boson, is what underlies it, what sets the scale of the mass. There's a problem called the Heirloom problem, which I
right.
talk about here and I talk about in actually all three of the books.
And that involves the dimension, extra dimensions.
It could involve extra dimension, but a very popular theory that isn't the extra dimensional idea is something called supersymmetry. Supersymmetry is, it's an extension of the symmetries of space and time, the symmetry that says physics looks the same in every direction, actually into the quantum regime. For those of you who know about quantum mechanics, it pairs together bosons and fermions. So for every particle we know about, there's another particle predicted. Now, of course, if that was really exact symmetry, we would have seen those particles already, because they would have the same masses and the same charges, so we would have seen them. So we know supersymmetry is not exact. It's broken a bit. But it can't be broken too much, or else it wouldn't answer the questions it's supposed to answer. And so there's a real mystery, because they haven't seen supersymmetry yet. And so it, and in fact...
And so many scientists I know are in love with it.
That's a good way of describing it. Because there's no experimental evidence yet, but there's theoretical reasons to like it. So basically, you have this theory where you know stuff has to be light for it to work. Yet, there are experimental constraints on certain particles that say they have to be heavy. We actually realized that a theory that had been thought about purely in a theoretical context, it was something called duality. It was a dual theory. It's where you had a weakly interacting theory and a strongly interacting theory. So you had a strongly interacting theory where you can't calculate. The coupling is just too big. The interactions are just too strong. They're always bouncing off each other. But there's an equivalent description in terms of a weakly interacting theory. And in the process of doing that, you can figure out what happens if supersymmetry breaks in the original strongly interacting. And it turned out that an automatic consequence was some of the particles would be heavy and some of them would be light. So if you just assume this, it would be very artificial. It would be like, supersymmetry is broken once, why should they be different? But it turns out that this very beautiful theoretical concept actually automatically gave rise to this difference, which no one had anticipated. We were studying for almost, I mean, it was interested in this question, and it turned out to just work beautifully. So that would be one example where the theoretical idea existed, hadn't been applied in the context of an actual physical problem of this sort, but we realized if you just followed through the consequences, it gave these very beautiful consequences.
Beauty is a property of science, isn't it, in some way?
Well, you know, sometimes if I describe my theories to you, you might not think they're that beautiful.
I might.
And beauty is very... you might. Maybe some people might as well. But it's a very subjective criteria, and I think a lot of time people are misled by the notion of beauty. They almost overly simplify, or they want things to... I mean, the universe is not that beautiful. It's really messy. So part of what I find exciting is to say, how can things be symmetric? How can they be order? How can there be principles? Yet have those principles broken also in a relatively simple way. So is there a simple way to break a symmetry such that you can actually describe the myriad phenomena in our universe? And that, to me, is interesting. In fact, the Higgs mechanism is about symmetry breaking.
Right.
And that's one of the exciting things about it. How does the symmetry break? But it's a very beautiful theory. Mm-hmm. But it's not often what people equate with beauty. But that, to me, is almost more beautiful.
Well, that beauty sort of led Einstein into various corners. I mean...
Right. It led him to good things, but then it later led him to dead ends.
That's right. So it's a sort of an interesting guide.
Right. And I think it was one of the Huxleys that said something like, you know, just basically an ugly truth can, you know, defeat a beautiful theory or something. That's very badly quoted. But but the fact is, you know, in science, it doesn't matter how beautiful you think an idea is. If there's an experiment that proves it's wrong, it's wrong.
Right. So is it...
And in fact, one of the ironies, sorry, I was going to say, of some of the theoretical work recently is that some of the theories that people thought were the ugliest just come back to haunt you. You think, I never wanted to look at this idea, and then it turns out it's relevant.
But if it's too inelegant, are you suspicious of it?
Well, if it's too cumbersome, it's not very compelling. And of course, if you test and it turns out to be right, I'll have to listen to you.
Right.
But before we have those experiments, you know, we just have these guiding principles. We have the data that we know about, we have things that we think can test, and then we have these guiding principles. And so if it is too ugly, we will throw it away. And in fact, sometimes that's been really good inspiration, because, you know, I'll be working with people like, this is getting way too, let's just start from the beginning. And often you come up with something much better if you do that. And sometimes the idea gets thrown away.
I think one of the things that baffles people about quantum mechanics is the probabilistic nature of it, that a thing is both there and not there at the same time, that you basically have to do calculations on the probability of things. And one of the things in this election year that was so much fun for me to read in Lisa's book is that Nate Silver himself, our very own guru of the liberal left, went to Lisa to check his probabilistic models. Is that fabulous? Let's hear one round of applause to Lisa. And by the way, to Nate Silver, too, to know who to go to, right? To basically figure out, you know, his problem.
He was really just interested in what kind of questions people ask. I think, you know, things are probabilistic, and so how do you do things like model things and think about these questions? I mean, I think he did a very good job of testing his own models. I will give him credit for that.
It came out pretty well.
Yeah, so I don't think I needed to do that. But I think it was just, you know, he was in the process of working on his book. And it was just interesting to ask about these kind of questions. How do you go about making predictions, and what are the kinds of things you predict? It was interesting for me to hear the kind of questions that he had, you know, to think about
when Kepler was predicting the orbits of the planets, he actually could anticipate where Venus was going to be next year.
And in fact, you know, this is, again, something people don't understand so well about. I mean, quantum mechanics does make predictions. They're just probabilistic in nature. So
right.
It's not that anything can happen. It's that certain things happen with certain probability.
Within a range. Yeah.
And I don't know, somehow, it's, you know, that's actually kind of satisfying. That part of it is kind of satisfying.
And you told me
everything.
You loved this about quantum mechanics.
Yeah, kind of everything in some sense, you know, there's some chance it's right. So, I mean, but there are...
Reality is probabilistic, isn't it? The way we go through the day is probabilistic.
Well, it's sort of what will happen to you. It's very
right.
Rarely really know anything, absolutely. But there are other weird aspects about quantum mechanics. There's a single particle. I mean, you know, we're happy to make probabilistic things about many particles. A single particle has a probabilistic interpretation. That's what's weird about quantum mechanics.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, it's just, you know, the whole notion of the famous double split experiment is that a single particle, you don't know where it went.
Right.
Now, of course, to test this, you need to have many particles because you can't see that. When one particle ends up one place or the other. But the fact that it's intrinsic in the nature that a single particle you're making some probabilistic distribution about, that's what's so weird.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of fabulous, too, in some kind of way.
I kind of agree with you.
It's fundamental weirdness. Mm-hmm. And I love fundamental weirdness, do you know? I find life absurd, so fundamental weirdness works for me. We're at the
this
Q&A.
This is why we love her.
We are at the Q&A section of tonight.
We'll start right here.
Hi. First of all, great conversation. So, in fact, I'll pick up the question somewhat for the conversation left off. It's about the state vector collapse happening. So I have read many interpretations about it, the most famous one being the Copenhagen one. But there are very different ones, very some radical ones as well. I want to have your take on that.
You know, I mean, this is going to be unsatisfying to you, but I don't worry about that. I mean, I know how quantum mechanics works. I know how it makes its predictions. And I can try to interpret it in some sort of classical language that is what we encounter. But it's not what we're doing. I mean, I know what the rules of quantum mechanics are, and I can calculate according to them. And that's what I do. And I don't bother trying to interpret it.
I love Copenhagen. It's such a good play, too. Did you see the play?
No, I haven't. Oh, it is a really good play.
It's brilliant. And even if you don't see it, read it. Because it reads as well as it...
And it is really clever because it really does... I mean, I actually met a friend because she was teaching it in the English department. And it really does use the analogies incredibly cleverly.
Incredibly well. So if you love this stuff, read that play. Michael Frayn, brilliant.
Hi. I'm a biology teacher at a local high school. I've read about the so-called unifying theory that attempts to unify, you know, string theory, quantum mechanics, and the theory of relativity. Do you think that those are just different ways of looking at matter, or is there in the near future a way of kind of combining all three in a way that makes sense as far as you can tell?
So I talk at length about this in both books. And you know, it's often presented like there's a contradiction or conflict between quantum mechanics and relativity. That's usually not true. What usually happens is quantum mechanics dominates at some scales, like small scales. Relativity is relevant on large scales. But it turns out there are extreme energy and distance scales where both would be relevant. You can't ignore either one of them. And it looks like there's some conflict there. And it really is true because we don't know how to calculate there. So just the same way we knew that quantum mechanics, there had to be something different because classical mechanics just didn't work. There is really strong evidence that we need a quantum theory of gravity. I mean, string theory is proposed to be that. We have yet to see, you know, can't experimentally test it, and we have yet to fully realize what it is and what its implications are. But it is clear that the fact, I mean, even if we can't test it, even if we can't get to the scales, we believe that ultimately there should be a consistent theory that describes everything, and that will be a quantum theory of gravity.
Can you help me understand the experiments done in the collider? Is that creating a new event, or is it mirroring the universe? In other words, in the universe, do protons accelerate and reach a higher energy state, and are particles created, or is this a function of this particular experiment?
That's a good question.
And the answer is yes, they do accelerate up to higher energies. And in fact, there's a whole chapter in this about, you know, this predictions about black holes in the universe. And one of the reasons that could they be produced at the collider, and one of the reasons we know, in addition to theory, that there's nothing dangerous that happens in the collider, is that the universe exists and things would look very different if there were dangerous processes. So in other words, yes, there are high-energy collisions in the universe. They're not high-energy collisions that we can study. I mean, as I said, the two things that are important about the collider are, one, the energy, and the other, the event rate. So enough collisions are happening that even these very rare events will happen, and there can be, and of course, the fact that we have control over the measurements, we can see what happens.
In warp space, right?
And possibly in warp space.
You've talked as if the frontier is really the experiment, and the machines to do that. My understanding of Einstein's process was a series of thought experiments and really a development from what I'd say is almost a philosophical theoretical process to get to his theory of relativity. And is there a place for that anymore, or is it really... the age of the machine?
So first of all, part of the reason we talk so much about the machine is because we've had this period with only theory. So the new thing that's happening now is that the experiments can test it. But it's also somewhat of a misconception about Einstein. Because Einstein, if you actually look at his first paper on relativity, I don't remember the exact title, but it was something about understanding electrodynamics. So he was doing his work very soon after, you know, we've finally understood electromagnetism. They've been put together, they've been measurements, there's a theory behind it. And in fact, his motivation for relativity was in part the fact that those equations required some sort of relativistic symmetries. They didn't work with classical symmetries. So yes, they were thought experiments, but they weren't just thought experiments. There was a lot of stuff that had developed into this theory of electromagnetism, which only made sense in certain ways. So yes, he was very clever and hadn't had thought experiments. But, of course, also it was very important that his theory was experimentally verified. Not everyone believed it until there really was an experiment. And there was other crazy stuff going on at the time. People were trying to understand masses from electromagnetism in ways that were completely different. So it's not like it's one or the other. And, in fact, his later work used mathematics more, but then his subsequent later work tried to use mathematics more and didn't work. So, I mean, ideally, in a place where science is really progressing, you want both theory and experiment. And, you know, I do theory. We've been doing theory for a long time, but we're excited because now there are experiments that can test some of the ideas and rule them out or say they're right.
And over here?
I have a question about fate. I spent a year in India many decades ago working with an Ayurvedic healer, meeting people who read palms, skulls, pulses, and all this stuff. And I lived with a bunch of Sanskrit scholars who said there was a book that had everybody's life worked out, that was passed among the sages, that from beginning to end, it was all written. Now, my question to you as a theoretical physicist is, what do you think about fatalism?
Okay, I think I'll let the audience vote on this.
We have a hardcore audience, I can tell.
Yeah. I don't think about it much. I mean, you know, I think there's some psychological things that make us end up doing something that's predetermined. I mean, actually, I will give you a semi-serious answer, which I thought there was this really interesting series, like 7-Up and 14-Up, what was it, where they did in Britain, and they followed people's lives. And it was amazing how hard it was for people to get out of their predetermined course in the sense of crossing class boundaries and things like that. So, yes, there are some things that are hard to change, but no, I don't believe in fatalism.
Question is a little bit in regards to, I'm sure you are familiar with the experience with one of the physicists who was asked, he was giving a lecture about, you know, how the Earth spins around the sun, and some lady stood up and said, you know, oh, bollocks, it's a turtle, and the Earth spins around the turtle, and he goes, but ma'am, what's holding up the turtle? And she says, it's turtles all the way down. Is it going to be turtles all the way down, do you think, especially, and maybe if you could talk a little bit about the Planck length? The Planck scale.
Well, so this is why. I mean, this is a really important theme, and scale. And
one more thing, just kind of in regards to what he was saying as well. Like, I know you don't think about, but ontology, the very fact that there's a subject viewing these experiments. Do you think about it at all? Does it come up? Does this bother you at all?
It doesn't bother me, but yes, we think about it. Okay, but I think. I also think that it's very useful and very pragmatic to have this. I mean, my first chapter is really about scale and understanding how ideas build on each other, what it means to be right and wrong. Because I think people get very disturbed that ideas change, and they change as you go to different scales. And the turtles all the way down, it's not turtles all the way down. It's a turtle, and then it's a duck, and then it's a, you know, it's just, there's really different ideas that appear at different scales. So, you know, and that's what's so exciting. If it was just finding the same thing over and over again, that wouldn't be very interesting. What's so interesting is we find fundamentally new things. And in fact, that's also sometimes what's disturbing, is the fundamentally new things seeming almost in contradiction to what was there before. But that's not true, because it's applying at different scales. And so what you're seeing, and of course, if we really had to know everything that was there, we'd never be able to say anything. I mean, I use the analogy of like Google Maps. You know, you can find your way around without knowing the detail of every street when you're going across the country. But then when you get there, you have to look more carefully. And so the same thing with science, that, you know, at the scale we look around the room now, we don't have to worry about quarks. But if you get down to that scale, you do have to worry about them. So I think it's a very beautiful way of how ideas integrate into each other.
Yeah, I'm not sure I have the right words, but there's so much stuff in the universe, matter and energy, and it's really large, and we don't quite know how large. Yet all of it was contained in a teeny little spot in the very beginning. So how did we get all that stuff into that little spot? I mean, what in the world is going on?
So first of all, there's nothing to set the scale at that point, right? So what do you mean by teeny? By teeny, you mean relative to something else. So if everything is teeny, then it all fits in. But there is actually a serious question there, which is sort of how what we call entropy was created. Where did all this stuff come from? And actually, there is a theory for that, which is called cosmological inflation. So the idea is that the universe expanded exponentially at some point, and then it stopped expanding. And at that point, and when it stopped expanding, whatever it is that caused that, all that energy gets converted into matter, and then a lot of matter gets created. And that's where we all come from. So we don't know the Big Bang, the very beginning, but there is a theory of this inflationary universe and what happened after. We don't know what caused inflation. There's a lot of details that are missing. But that's where we believe all the stuff got created. And it was really small then, too.
Inflation. It's not just an economic theory.
Hi, I was at a Sean Carroll talk at Caltech yesterday, and I overheard two people saying that the discovery of the Higgs field as having a value...
Higgs boson.
The Higgs boson. Was potentially problematic for both supersymmetry and string theory, so I wanted to ask what that rules out. Or if it's restrictive?
It doesn't say anything about string theory. It does say something about supersymmetry potentially, and I'm not going to go into all the details, but in the simplest versions of supersymmetric theory, you would predict a Higgs boson that's a little bit lighter than that. So to make it to have this Higgs boson with the particular mass that was measured requires a different sort of... It's not just supersymmetry, it's also how supersymmetry breaks. And it tells us something about the supersymmetry breaking and the supersymmetric theory. So it's just, it's sort of a constraint if there is. I mean, the more serious problem for supersymmetry is the fact that we have no evidence for it yet. I mean, that really is a problem. We would have expected at the energy scales they're exploring, in the simplest versions, there should have been stuff that was found already, or at least indirect evidence. We haven't seen that. So that's a more serious constraint.
My question is whether you think the brain is a good enough tool for theories today. Hundreds of years ago, Isaac Newton had very simple explanatory formulas for phenomena that people were able to observe at the time. Today we have so much experimental data, it seems when you think about the different mechanisms, for example, for cancer, it becomes so complicated, and there are so many different factors that must be taken into account to explain data that it seems difficult for the brain to conceptualize all those things at the same time.
So there's sort of two parts to the answer to that. I mean, one is, if it was so simple for Newton, why didn't everyone do it? And the fact is that at Newton's time, it wasn't that simple, and it was a series of both measurements and advances in developing mathematics that he developed, calculus. Several people guessed it was one over r squared. I mean, Newton was the only one that really figured it out, figured out why a mass acted like the mass was all at the center and why there was a one over r squared force law. So that's a big deal, and it's not... And so at the time, what he was doing was at the edge, and it wasn't like everyone could do it. Newton could do it. And in some sense, it's like that today, very likely. But what I will say is true is we're trying to answer very different kinds of questions. I mean, one of the ironies about particle physics is considered so complex, but it's actually very simple. We're trying to get to these energy scales because that's where the laws of physics are simple. You can identify fundamental ingredients and see how they interact. Problem like cancer or biology or any of these problems, it's a complex system where it's not just a simple fundamental ingredient. There's two things going on. One is what are the fundamental laws? The other is, how do these complex systems work? What are the feedback mechanisms? How does it all interact? And I actually do think it's a good question how science will develop in light of that. What you do in biology is, on the whole, very different than what you do in physics. They're both science, but they're very different kinds of science. And it probably will evolve, and there's a lot of numerical stuff going on right now to try to see like how things look different when it's cancerous. And it's a very different kind of way of trying to find an explanation, a cure. But it's also one of the reasons it has been so difficult to solve most forms of cancer. I joke sometimes, it's not that funny, but you know, cancer we've solved in the perturbative regime. I mean, if you find it early enough, you can solve it. You know, once you find it late, it's just all over the place, and you can't do anything about it. And part of the art of science today is trying to find those simple rules within these very complex systems.
Hi. My question was about dark matter. Some scientists say that there's dark matter flowing through us right now. And my question is, like, if dark matter doesn't interact with the electromagnetic force, would that mean that dark matter would fall down to the center of gravity, like, for instance, Earth, or the center of gravity of the sun? Like, how would that affect the gravitational force in those objects?
So an individual particle, for an individual particle, gravity is usually a very weak force, extremely weak force. Like, if you have two electrons or two protons, it's like more than 40 orders of magnitude smaller than electromagnetism. So dark matter, you know, it's moving quite a big velocity. It's just going through. It's just passing through. And so... For dark matter to have an effect, you need a lot of it. Just the same way for like Earth's gravity to have an effect, you need a lot of it. So so cosmologically, there's certainly effects of dark matter. In a galaxy, there's effects of dark matter. So when we look for dark matter, we look for either individual particle interactions, just seeing that they collide and produce other stuff, or they come through the Earth, and then we just look for the tiny kick it would give something as it goes through. So those are the kind of things we look for.
You said Nate Silver called you. Senator Marco Rubio of Florida said today we don't know how old the universe is. 7 days, seven eras. There's no way to know. There's many theories. If he calls you tomorrow, what will you tell him?
I really would kind of ask him first, like, where he got educated. I mean, I really am curious how someone could sit. And it also, I really would be curious how someone could not be embarrassed to say those kind of things. So I think I really would get started at those angles.
Hi, Lisa. I'm a devotee of your appearances on Charlie Rose. But this is fairly heady stuff you talk about, and you encounter audiences of varying degrees of intelligence. What strategies...
Knowledge. I prefer to think of it as knowledge.
Knowledge. What strategies do you use when trying to explain things to people that, again, probably press limits of their understanding?
You know, it really depends on the audience. People here, I mean, I think we could safely assume we're kind of interested in science. But I'm serious. I mean, there's some people that you just have to start off by getting at why we care about these questions at all. There are some people that really are trying to follow. I mean, I think I was approaching it more from the point of view of thinking that there are some people that really want to understand what's going on. And I definitely will challenge the reader a little bit, because I want to give a complete story, and I want people to be asking the kinds of questions that I would ask. And of course, you know, you don't have all the technological tools, but you can think about some of the concepts that are there. So when I wrote my first book especially, I mean, I really made a gamble. I thought, you know, there's some books that were in it, like, for everybody, and there's some books that were in it very technically. And I thought there were people in between who really just want to get a complete story that they're not going to get overnight, but that they can really go back and understand what's going on. But in any given explanation, you know, is it best done by analogy? Is it best done by trying to really get at the underlying concepts? I mean, there's no one answer, and I really just try to think it through.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Errant Fox, City National Bank, KPMG, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the Bujaki Foundation. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Council of the Library Foundation, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and LA Weekly. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.